I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jesse Eisinger, who is a senior reporter at ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. He was a regular columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section, and in April of 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. His latest book is The Chicken Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jesse Eisinger.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you very much. And just in terms of the Justice Department failing, they lost a big one with Judge Richard Leon approving the $85.4 billion mega merger between AT&T and Time Warner with no conditions. And then we learned shortly thereafter that Comcast is making a $65 billion bid for 20th Century Fox, setting off a bidding war with the Disney company. So it seemed that there's an obvious connection there, isn't there, Jesse?
Oh, there's certainly a connection. The Department of Justice tried to make a stand against the AT&T Time Warner merger. It was a risky bet, and it didn't pay off in a spectacular way. It was a big risk and a very surprising stance from a Republican administration to try to block this merger, and just Leon really slapped them down. A big, big defeat for the DOJ.
There was always a sense that this was rather a selective prosecution, in as much as, well, in effect, it's an example of Donald Trump's vindictiveness. He was angry at CNN and that he was really behind the Justice Department's move against this merger. Is there anything to that?
I think there may be something to it. I mean, the biggest problem here is that we just don't know, and that the prospect was raised that there was some kind of interference or meddling or even just kind of policy done to please the president. So if you recall, Trump came out against the merger during the campaign. At the same time, roughly, Machen Delrahim, who later would become the head of the antitrust division at the Department of Justice, said he saw no problem with the merger, which is the orthodox Republican laissez-faire argument for this kind of merger, which is called a vertical merger, where companies that don't directly compete with each other, combining, and they have different operations in the same kind of industry. So it's not like two widget makers getting together. It's like the aluminum maker that goes into the widgets buying the widget maker here, a vertical merger. And the orthodox view is from laissez-faire economists is that vertical mergers don't really pose big competition problems in the kind of classic antitrust way that the way the antitrust law has evolved over the last 40 years. So, but you had this wild card here of Trump saying this, and then lo and behold, Machen Delrahim reverses his view and goes against what ostensibly is his ideology and opts to try to block the deal. Now, the mystery here and the unresolved issue is, did the White House have an explicit hand in this? Did they have an implicit hand in this? We just don't know.
Well, the ruling itself, though, is pretty extraordinary, in as much as the judge told the DOJ not to appeal, and AT&T was facing a $500 million breakup fee. So not only do they get the deal, but they were saved $500 million in penalties. So what do you make of this, Judge? Talk about laissez-faire.
It was almost a done deal that the DOJ was going to lose once they drew Judge Leon. He's an orthodox libertarian judge and was going to be unlikely to be persuaded by the DOJ's arguments. You have to understand the bar now, the legal bar, the antitrust bar, is extremely wary of any arguments for almost any mergers, really. The way the law has evolved, the case has to be so definitively bad for consumers, so obviously bad for consumers, that for judges to turn away a deal and allow the DOJ to block a deal. And in this case, this was the first vertical merger being challenged in in a generation. And there just is no real law behind this. Now, there are a lot of good economic arguments against vertical mergers, particularly this vertical merger. And there are a lot of arguments that have nothing to do with economics, but have a lot to do with public policy and politics and corporate power and influence. But those have just simply not been taken up by the bar. And so you have to win these cases on economics and on a narrow view of the law. And the DOJ just hasn't developed that law.
So I thought that the Clayton Act and the Sherman Act were quite powerful. So are you saying that they're simply not being used?
You're absolutely right. They are incredibly powerful. But the law has really changed. Without actually literally changing the Clayton and Sherman Acts, the law has evolved to a much more narrow question. So the Clayton Act and the Sherman Act and the early years of antitrust, for the first, you know, roughly 70 years of antitrust enforcement, 60, 70 years, you could interpret the damage to a merger in a multitude of ways, including considering things like whether the new entity was going to be too powerful or warp our politics, something like that. Those were kind of qualitative rather than quantitative measures. It's hard to measure political power. But then there was a revolution in antitrust in the 1970s led by a guy named Robert Bork, who famously was denied a seat on the in the Supreme Court under Reagan in the 1980s. And this revolution essentially narrowed the question of antitrust. This was the Chicago School of economics, narrowing the question of antitrust away from these abstract notions, away from these qualitative notions, and really just raising, just examining the question of, is this bad for consumers? Does this raise prices for consumers? And this has allowed a wave of mergers that has started in the 1980s and really continued unabated up to today.
And again, I'm speaking with Jesse Eisinger, who's a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He was a regular columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section. And in April of 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. And his latest book is The Chicken Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Well, there were 50,000 mergers in 2017 and about another 50,000 mergers in 2016 and 2015. And apparently companies spent over $2 trillion on mergers in 2018 so far. And, of course, they're not just in the telecom and entertainment business, as with AT&T and Time Warner and Disney and Fox and Comcast. There was also a huge merger, was there not, between Monsanto and Bayer? And they rather cynically dropped the name Monsanto for the new entity, because a lot of activists find the name Monsanto rather toxic.
Right. Well, so we have we've had these big merger waves, as you suggest, and we've had lax antitrust enforcement for a long time under George W. Bush. There was lax enforcement under Obama. There really was quite unimpressive step up in enforcement, a mild step up enforcement, especially in the later years when the mergers were so audacious that they were really creating concentrated giants where the number one and number two players were merging, and they were so it was so audacious that the DOJ had no choice but to try to block that. But we have many economists have come to believe a big corporate concentration problem, that this merger waves after merger waves have resulted in giant areas of the economy that have monopolies or oligopolies. Now, you know, so people are familiar with the huge tech companies like Facebook and Amazon and Google that arguably are effectively monopolies in their areas or have enormous economic power. But there are many industries that people don't really think about at all. Logistics, agriculture, shipping, these kinds of industries also are highly concentrated. And people are worried that this concentration is leading to a wide variety of ills, like a lack of innovation, a lack of startups and companies, a collapse in wages, that companies have become too powerful in purchasing wages and they can keep wages down, and a warping of our politics. So there seems to be a huge concentration problem. It seems to be hurting economic growth and damaging our politics. But the legal profession either has not caught up to this or has no answers for it.
Well, the big five companies that are now dominant, I mean, 10 years ago, ExxonMobil was the most powerful company in the world, and now it's Google or Alphabet, and you've got Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, and Amazon, and they're all growing so much in monopoly power that in 10 years' time, my God, they'll be even more massive. So if you think they're powerful now, just look at the trajectories they're on.
Sure. And the counter argument is that tech is very unpredictable and changes, and that Microsoft was incredibly powerful in the 1990s and the DOJ sought to block it. And there was a wave of innovation irrespective of the DOJ that Microsoft was on the way out. But it looks like now that Facebook and Google in particular are highly entrenched, and maybe even Amazon, although it's a slightly different case, but that they're highly entrenched, that they look like monopolies, that they are wield enormous amount of market power. Now, the thing that confounds antitrust economists and antitrust lawyers who want to go up against these is that they're good for consumers. They're free. You know, Google is a free product. Facebook is a free product. And so when you look at them and say, is this damaging consumers? The answer is no. Or the answer is not through the pocketbook, maybe through other things, because it turns out, of course, that we're selling something when we use a free service. We're selling our privacy. We're selling our personal information. They're marketing. You know, the old expression now is you are the product. We are the product when we go on Facebook. But this confounds antitrust, and the government doesn't have an answer for this. And it's going to have to formulate something over the next several years, because there is an enormous amount of concern about not only their power, but also their abuses, like their privacy abuses.
Well, I think it's called surveillance capitalism, isn't it? That's their business model.
Exactly. It is. And people are suddenly coming to realize this and becoming deeply uncomfortable that it's not just that people are selling us products, but that they're selling us presidential candidates that we might not have wanted to purchase. You know, that it's warping our politics, that or it's becoming manipulated, you know, that our politics is becoming manipulated, that they're selling fake news, that they are easily, you know, to reaching people and tailoring messages that involve misleading information, and that's hard to combat that, or that they're selling us our private information to parties that we don't want to have that, who we don't want to have that information. So there are deeply malign consequences to the rise of these tech giants. But also, you know, there are other areas, as I say, of the economy that are highly concentrated that may be having malign effects on our wages, on innovation. And we have not grappled with this as a society. In fact, economists are still debating whether this corporate concentration is a problem. But from a kind of lay person's point of view, it's kind of self-evidently a problem, and they're just playing catch-up.
Well, just back to AT&T and the Time Warner merger, which seems to have prompted a challenge by Comcast to go after 20th Century Fox, and Walt Disney and Fox were in the midst of making a deal. And, of course, Comcast, prior to this, had already combined with NBC Universal, and that's obviously a trend following what's happening yesterday with Time Warner and AT&T. It's the marrying of content with distribution, and big telecoms have the pipe, and they want to fill up the pipe with all this content, which will lead to more bundling. And I don't know anyone on this planet who likes their cable company, because they are monopolies and they seem to keep charging us more for less. So on top of that, net neutrality has just ended. So can you give us a kind of macro picture here? Because it doesn't feel to me like the trend is going in a friendly direction for consumer choice, but rather they're going towards enormous power to dictate content.
You know, I feel wary of predicting where the media market is going to be in 10 years. But right now, these companies are merging because they're very afraid of the incoming threats from people like Netflix and the internet, and you know, being able to watch entertainment on your phone in from YouTube and Facebook and things like that. So there is a panic in the marketplace, and this is what's leading AT&T to merge with Time Warner and the other mergers that you're talking about, Comcast. And so their business models are under pressure. Is this going to be bad for consumers? Well, it seems clearly one answer would be yes, that we're going to be faced with fewer choices. You know, the companies are promising that they're not going to hinder choices, that they're not going to prevent you from getting the entertainment you want, because they say it's not in their interests to do it. And we'll see if they can keep those promises. Now, AT&T and Time Warner don't have to keep any promises because their merger was cleared without it. You know, the DOJ may appeal this, but I doubt that they will. So the merger will go through and they'll be restricted on nothing. Now, will they adhere to good behavior because of the competition? Well, there's less competition now, and there's more interest for all these companies to effectively fix prices, to have an understanding between, to keep prices up and maybe to restrict choice. So we're in a brave new world. It's a very fast moving industry. There's a lot of potential competition, but their companies are figuring out how to cut the competition off at the pass and keep prices up. And I think that's quite worrisome.
And just in closing, it seems like Amazon, they have the ability to buy up what's left. The studios like Lionsgate and Apple and Facebook and Google are getting into production. And Sprint, of course, has announced a deal with T-Mobile, which in turn has a deal with Netflix. And then it turns out that Netflix is, by the way, their market capitalization is even bigger than Disney's. So these new companies are really creeping up on everybody, aren't they? And I mean, they've really got some clout and an enormous amount of content.
And they, as you just alluded to, they've got funny money in their currency, you know. So Amazon makes almost no profit, but has an enormous equity value and can use it to buy companies. And Netflix has enormous equity value, much greater equity value than, you know, Disney, even though Disney makes literally billions in profits and Netflix barely makes hundreds of millions in profits. So the market thinks that these up and coming, you know, tech companies are going to be disruptive and threaten the giants. To some extent, they are threatening the giants. And now that the DOJ has been slapped down on its AT&T Time Warner bid to block that deal, you know, these tech companies are going to be able to use their funny money to buy all sorts of companies. You know, Amazon got into the grocery business with Whole Foods. These tack-on mergers that increase their market power and increase their concentration and dominance, but don't trigger any antitrust reviews or any economic concerns from antitrust economists. Those are the kinds of things that actually entrench these companies. So I think we're going to see many more mergers, more concentration, and we're going to end up with, you know, a handful of companies dominating the economic landscape. And I don't think that anyone would think that's a really good outcome for the economy or the society.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I've been speaking with Jesse Eisinger, who is a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He was a regular columnist for the New York Times Dealbook section. And in April of 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. And his latest book is The Chicken Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
line written down in America.